We come to the 15th presentation in a series, Hermetic Bodhisattvas, which is to a large extent about time forms. Yesterday, News Daily, Science News Daily, had a wonderful little article on a discovery in Guatemala, in the Zultan province of Guatemala, which is the lowland Mayan beautiful area, jungly. And the article was that they found for the first time paintings intact on walls from 800 AD of the Mayan calendar. And in translating it, it isn't that on December 21st, 2012, that time will come to an end and the world will come to an end, but that an age will have gone its course and the next one will commence. And further in doing the translations, the explorers, archaeology scholars, were able to see that the Mayan time forms go on for trillions of years. So you can stop worrying. One of the interesting things about the Zultan Mayas is that they have a heritage of Chinese blood. They were visited in the 400s AD by Chinese small fleet that had crossed the Pacific Ocean and had come down. We know because a stone anchor was found in San Diego Bay, shaped like a Chinese bee. It's a circular disc with a large hole in it, and it was used as an anchor to hold the ship while teams were being dispatched. The bee is a symbol in China of heavenly power. But the lowland Mayas and some of the highland Mayas, deeper into the mountains, have extraordinary features that startle one because they are not features of the typical Indians of America, of the Americas. I recall in the early 1980s, teaching at the Philosophic Research Society on Los Feliz Boulevard, and I would give special events at that time. And one is I brought in a filmmaker from Santiago, Chile, a friend of mine, Rolando Klein, who had made a beautiful color film called Chak for Chakmul, the rain god of the Mayans. And after showing the film, it was the premiere. It had never been seen in the United States before. And Rolando had brought one of the villagers, because there were no actors. It was the villagers in the highland who were suffering a drought and had to make rain. And they went to a shaman who said the only way that they could make rain is that if he had a seed of the mother of waters, which was down in the jungles, which were precarious to the highland Mayans, and that those jungle lowland Mayans would take them into a sacred journey into a very deep cave, and there they could get a pail at the bottom of the cenote in the cave of the mother of waters and gingerly take it all the way back to up the mountains to the shaman who then would make rain. Just to follow it up, they did not know that his life powers would be consumed and he would die making the rain. But one of the villagers was brought and he was sitting on stage. And you could see the ancient Chinese features in him. It was astounding, a living being. The Zoltan Mayans preserved a very esoteric grouping of understandings, not only of time and time cycles, what we now here are calling time forms, but also a whole pattern of ancient wisdom, which was not characteristic of the Americas at all, but was characteristic of the esoteric, hermetic West that went through Central Asia into China about the second century, early second century AD. A good friend of mine, Peter Ballen, and it's interesting because his name translates, Peter means stone, and Ballen in Mayan is jaguar. So his name was Stone Jaguar, we used to call him. And he's the one who designed the Zoltan Tarot deck, taking the symbolic patterning of the Zoltan Maya and showing that it could be expressed in a tarot deck. And the book that goes with it was published, and it's called Flight of the Feathered Serpent, published by another old friend of mine, Ken Reed, Wisdom Garden Books here in Los Angeles. And the suit of cups in the Zoltan Maya is the great cycle path of water. So that the suits of the tarot deck, the four suits, which are ancient hermetic symbol pattern, is able to be expressed in Maya, Zoltan Maya imagery quite adequately. Here's a photo of Peter Ballen and myself. I'm holding my daughter Nokomis Sarah Weir. She was dressed as she was five for Halloween that year, and she's dressed as a Javanese princess. And Peter and I were very close, like I am still with a number of people here in Los Angeles whom I've known for 40 years. It's interesting to see that the core of understanding what used to be called esoteric or occult, the core of it is to be able to get traction in time. Because time, as the first dimension, is the source of energy in the universe. Time fuels instantly space in its expansive mode to disclose a field. And the field is purely empty space. but out of the purely empty space, because it also is sourced in a spontaneous energy. Time does not occur instantly, but spontaneously. And because it is spontaneous, it spontaneously fertilizes the zero field of space to begin to manifest, is the best word, a primordial pair in a plasma. And the primordial pairing are quarks and gluons, to use nuclear physics. And the quark gluon plasma is special because the gluons do only one thing. They hold together subatomic particles. And when they do that in a plasma, when the plasma further integrates, quarks share a gluon and become, the alchemical term is annealed, so that they pair, so that the quarks have give up the ability to be distinguishable individually, but they occur as a pair. And when quarks pair, they're also able to share their pairing with a third. And when you have quarks that have a chiral quality to them in their spin, in their movement, and when you have two down quarks and one up quark, you begin to get proton. And when you have two up and one down, you get to have a neutron. And you begin to have the core of an atomic structure that lends itself to pairing with electrons, which are enormously complicated. They're not just particles, but they carry with them cells all the time on three levels of energy: an electron, a muon, a tau particle. They carry with them the zero field as a space, which is popularly called electron holes. So they not only have themselves capable of being at three levels of energy, but they have their own holes. And they also have an opposite, not an anti-electron, but they have a positron, which also has a hole. So that you begin to see that there is a complex structure where pairing is, as Lao Tzu says in the Tao Te Ching, pairing is the deepest that we can go until we are absorbed into the Tao, which doesn't need to have any particles or energy or waves at all, but invites it all to occur. It's a gift. It's an invitation. The pairing of pairs is the foundation of the way in which, in an integral mode, eventually it occurs to us as a frame of reference, as the frame of the picture of where the images belong in this composition. In my The Learning Civilization 2-year program, this is modified and it's called the square of attention, because it is not just a square of reference, but is a square of attentiveness of the mind in its integral occupation, which is to bring things together, to be able to get the picture, and eventually to be able to, as the British Empire used to say, get the big picture. Then one has a worldview, a Weltanschauung, a way of looking at everything in terms of one's attentive, referential comprehension. And all of this becomes exceedingly complexified when it comes to civilization, because civilization has a triple time form braid, and not only has the ability to be able to get the big picture of the universe, but is able to go through the picture like an Alice through the in Wonderland and through the looking glass, and go into a completely rare field, not the zero field of nature, but the infinite field of consciousness. And that infinite field of consciousness is differential rather than integral, and comes into a complementarity, a play, where they pair, but the they-ness of the pair is a zero field and an infinite field, so that you get an all possible worlds, not an omniverse, but a cosmos. That's the way to talk about it. The interesting thing is that the pair of chirality does not have to be left-handed and right-handed as in a pair that is distinct in this way, but they can pair together like two hawks hunting, two falcons hunting together, and you can see the Chinese Tai Chi movement comes out of that. And in that way, the double helix becomes the form of DNA of all life forms that we know, and has that kind of right-handed chirality shared in that pair. But it's apparent that there are quite feasibly and certainly possible life forms that have the other chirality of a left-handed DNA, which is quite interesting because it shows that one can begin to understand in such a way that comprehension has a further refinement. The comprehension is to get the big picture and understand it really rather well, completely. But higher in energy is the term excellently used by Karl Jaspers, one of the great philosophers of the 20th century. And the English translation of his term is encompassing. Beyond comprehension, there's encompassing. And the encompassing is a differentiality of consciousness that doesn't go for frames of reference, but goes for matrices and complex multiple vectors that, when they're paired initially, become mathematically tensors, and that one can then use a high conscious tensor calculus, like someone like Einstein, to be able to understand space-time, not as a big picture, but as a fabric of the universe, that has the ability then for space-time to host in the fabric of space-time wells of gravity as integrated phenomena become larger and larger, so that you begin to have the texture of the fabric weighted down, and when it becomes dense enough, like a black hole, it punctures through the fabric back into the, not the singularity. This is where the mind becomes deceived by an integral preference in structure. It accesses the zero field. And that zero field is able then not to be a singularity in an ultimate big picture frame of reference, but to be the phenomenal disappearance of integral alone, so that one begins then to understand that we now need to mature so that we don't just see the onenesses of things, but that we carry with our encompassing all of the zero spaces that allow for anything of any size to become a, the smallest is a quanta. A quanta of what? A quanta of energy. Max Planck's great discovery in 1897 of there is a mathematical way to express a single quanta, but in order for it to be single, it has to be in a context where there is nothing at all. But that nothing at all, because it's not subject to the laws of phenomenality, can be as close as possible, and yet not touch, but resonate. So that resonance, not causality, is the differential rule of science. And that's why one looks not to see just the big picture, but one also has to understand the resonant patterns interfacing or interfering or coming into a harmonic or an anharmonic, and that in doing so, it's apparent that there are symbolic structures. The most powerful of them is from the Chinese for the I Ching, going back about 5,000 years, which was one of the first times, about 3,000 BC, that human civilization came to understand that if you work with a movement and a repose, if you work with the rhythm of movement and repose, if you work with ones and zeros in a binary, in a play of levels of change, one can then come to understand that with a certain complexity of a matrix, you could easily come to characterize any possibilities whatsoever, because you could eventually become enough acquainted with that working pilot matrix that you could then begin to understand any amount of complexity whatsoever, or go back into the very origins. And with the I Ching, a movement and its repose, its ones and zeros, can be paired in such a way, if you express the movement as a line and you express the repose as a broken line, not one and two, but one and none. It's the space in between that one symbolically looks at. And out of this, eventually, you get eight possibilities when you add a repeat a third line. You can repeat either the open or the movement. And if you triple that, you get a set of eight trigrams, as they're called, and that set of eight trigrams will develop 64 hexagrams. One of the most brilliant bodhisattvas of the 20th century was Marie-Louise von Franz. She was the one who first realized that there is a scientific and philosophic and psychological correspondence between DNA and the I Ching. She did this in 1968, but she did it quietly. She's a very quiet, very deep woman, very much on the level we talked about last week with Vimala Sagar. Her insight was a long time in coming. She was born in 1915 in Munich. She was the daughter of a German baron, so her name is von Franz. And she was always, as a girl, quite quiet and deep, insightful, and she had the wonderful fortune, as we would say, at 18 to meet Carl Jung. So this was in 1933. And one of the things that Carl Jung was doing at that time in 1933, he was understanding that his good longtime friend who had passed away just a couple of years before, Richard Wilhelm, who was the great translator of the I Ching out of Chinese into German. And Jung had a beautiful translator, and the name is Carrie F. Baines. And she was doing The Secret of the Golden Flower, which was Jung and Richard Wilhelm writing together in German, an understanding of a very sophisticated Taoist yoga from about 500 years before in China. And Jung understood that she was able to go with H.G. Baines, that her husband, that now the German of Richard Wilhelm's I Ching could be translated into English, which it was. And the first edition in the Bollingen series was 1950 in two volumes, and since then has sold millions of copies in the single volume, and then shrunk down to a little yellow hardcover, which has been popular all over the world. What is interesting is that in all of this time, being acquainted with Jung, from the time at which the I Ching that had miraculously moved from Chinese to German in the 1920s. He worked on it for about 10 years. He was from a German missionary family. And he was struck by an attack of amoebic dysentery and was incapacitated for months on end and near death. And the Chinese sent in a Taoist master, and his ability to heal Richard Wilhelm impressed Wilhelm so much that he began to study with him. And as he studied with him, it became apparent that he himself, having gone through that illness, having been healed from that illness, now had a super sensitive insight. And because he could speak Chinese and read Chinese quite well, and of course immensely literate in German, very complex German, he began under that tutelage for about 10 years to make the translation of the I Ching. And in doing so, he was able to understand with like a heightened fifth dimension vision to be able to see beyond what had been assumed about the I Ching, not only by Europeans, but by Chinese themselves. Jung asked in 1933, one of the most famous Chinese philosophers at the time, his name was Hu Shi, and Hu Shi had studied under John Dewey at Columbia and had carried Dewey's great philosophic thinking, which is very complex, back into China, but had dismissed the I Ching as being a superstitious book of spells, as had the only English translation of it in the Sacred Books of the East by James Lege, who dismissed the I Ching, though he made a translation of it, still in print from Dover paperbacks, but assumed, like Hu Shi, that it was just a simple collection of superstition and spells. It's like the Egyptian Book of the Dead, when it was first being translated, the various written sections were called spells. Well, they're anything but spells. They are poetic differentials, differential consciousness, the way in which one learns to see through, not just into, like in an inner world, but through as in a transparency of the symbols themselves. And when the symbols become more and more transparent, it becomes obvious in a rather large way that there is no division of inner and outer whatsoever, including time. There's no past and future which are distinct and held apart by a present moment, a particle of time called the present now, which one can get and then have all kinds of success at money, sex, whatever, influence, that it's a delusion to think of time being split in this way and that the present moment being objective, that time as an energy actually is a continuum, and that one can move on this continuum with the right patterns of flow. And that flow is the development of the dimensions of consciousness, so that one eventually has a yoga that is there for the four dimensions of natural cycles, like a karma yoga, or a hatha yoga, or a bhakti yoga, but that there are higher yogas, like a raja yoga, that brings the entire pattern of them to a transparency, so that one sees through to further dimensions. And out of that comes a lens, not a lens of phenomenality, but a lens as like a prism which shows the rainbow of possibilities. And that that rainbow of possibilities then is an access threshold to the infinite field of consciousness, which when it's brought into play with the zero field of nature, and at the same time paired with that, exchanges the process of remembering with differential consciousness, one can bring that into the symbolic structure of the mind. And there it becomes phenomenal as the memory, as a memory, which one can organize then integrally. And in that exchange, because it's not just a penetration by consciousness into the structure of symbolic thought of the mind, but the mind exchanges and gives the imagination, which is a part of the symbolic structure of the mind, to the differential conscious visioning, and there it becomes creative imagining. And the creative imagining, freed from having to be just the index of images, like an image base, or an image lexicon, or an image dictionary, or an image encyclopedia, it's like the net. Images. But when it goes into the infinite field of vision, visionary differential consciousness in creative imagining is able to bring new forms into not just being, but into prismatic being. And works of art are this. And those men and women who can do this are the artists. And so the whole dimension of art comes into play as a sixth dimension. And as it comes into play, there's a deeper exchange. And the deeper exchange is that vision has gone not only into the zero field of nature with the infinite field of consciousness, so that new magical forms can emerge spontaneously out of nature. But when you bring the dimension of art into play, the next phase ritual gets transformed as well, so that it is able to work with the new, spontaneous, magical forms, and now you begin to have a kaleidoscopic cosmos, which we need to take a break and let that be appreciated. Last week, in the presentation, we looked at Vimala Sakar as a hermetic bodhisattva of the 20th century. We're looking in this presentation at the context building towards Marie-Louise von Franz, both great hermetic bodhisattvas of the 20th century. And there is a relationality that also is building, but will take a couple of presentations to mature, to age, so that one can appreciate a very fine cognac that is being developed here. I brought three of Marie-Louise von Franz's books, and just to alert you, and we'll develop more, and also more from many hermetic bodhisattvas of the 20th century. One of them that I showed last week was from this series, edited by Jill Peirce, published by Thames and Hudson, London and New York. And this volume of hers is Time, and its subtitle is Rhythm and Repose. And all of these volumes have not only their text, but they have illustrations. And on the back of this is the feathered serpent that's not only about time in a Mayan sense, but also there are traces of the way in which the dragon is mysterious. And eventually we will get to those kinds of depths in our development here. Another of her books is written with Carl Jung's wife, Emma Jung, on the Grail legend. And we will eventually disclose a great deal that has not been understood about the Grail. In that series by Jill Peirce, there is a volume on the Grail, and of course, cognate with it, a volume on King Arthur. The whole series was the Illustrated Library of Sacred Imagination, but also cognate with it is one on the Celtic mysteries. And next week we'll take a look at one of the great hermetic bodhisattvas of the 20th century, E.Y. Evans Wentz, who, much to the surprise of almost everyone, was able to take himself out of a San Diego, California original background early in the 20th century and to go to England and then to go into Ireland and then to write a beautiful volume on the Celtic imagination. I'll bring in a first edition of that next week as well. But he is world famous for being the one who was able to make an English translation of the Tibetan Book of the Dead at a time when almost no one understood the great complexities of the Vajrayana. Similar to that, this presentation is the way in which Richard Wilhelm was able to understand something that even well-educated intellectual Chinese did not appreciate, and that was the I Ching, and to make a translation of it, because his Taoist master teacher, his name was Lao Nai Xuan, and he tutored Richard Wilhelm like Lama Kazi Dawa Samdup in Tibet tutored E.Y. Evans Wentz, because they sensed that here is a spirit person who now, because they are comfortable in the infinite field of conscious vision, able to function with the complementarity of differential and integral, were worthy of being given not the keys to an esoteric wisdom, but to be given the facility so that their learning would be able to be open as they continued, and not just, the mathematical term is recursive, the psychological term is regressive. If you do not enter the lucid field of the ecology of consciousness, the tendency is for there to be a backflow and for the symbolic structure of the mind to consider that this was its own inner quality that was previously unconscious, and now one is bringing it up into consciousness. And this is a self-defeating learning. Another one of Marie-Louise von Franz's books is a great commentary and translation of the golden ass of Apuleius. Apuleius lived in the second century, born somewhere around 120 and lived into the 180s AD. He was brought up in Madura, which is in the Roman North African province of Africa, and was an extraordinary figure. There are two really wonderful, popular, priced translations of it, one in Penguin Classics and one Oxford's World Classics. Both of them are quite good. The Jungian discussion of the psychological importance of Apuleius was originally focused on one of the 15 chapters of The Golden Ass. It's about, ostensibly, a man who, under a curse, becomes a donkey, a mule, an ass, and goes through a huge amount of difficulties with human beings because he's quite conscious as a man, but he can't do anything much but just be an ass. And he is finally saved by Isis, and she is able to help him transform back into his humanness. But one of the chapters is called Amor and Psyche. Amor as the feminine of mankind, hidden in the male, and Psyche is the male of mankind hidden in the feminine, so that there is a possibility not just of a meeting, but of an exchanging. But when the exchanging occurs, it's an exchanging of a pair of pairs and not just two becoming one. To think that two become one is to misunderstand, like thinking the broken line of the trigrams or the hexagrams of the I Ching is the two-ness. It's the zero-ness that is being disclosed. Only an encompassing is able to understand that. One cannot perceive it. One cannot conceive it. There is an apperception that comes close, but there is an encompassing that is exact to any degree of specificity or non-specificity whatsoever. The Jungian commentary on that chapter, Amor and Psyche, is by Eric Neumann, who is one of the great Jungians of the 20th century. You might be familiar with his great study called The Great Mother, the exploration of the archetype of the Great Mother, and a volume on the history of consciousness. But his little study on Amor and Psyche, about the pair of exchanges where Psyche becomes questioning about Amor because she has not been able to see him clearly in all of his natural. And so when he is asleep, she, in the fairy tale language of Apuleius, brings in a light to see who it is really who is her lover. And she begins to see that he's just a man, another one of them. And so he goes away. And only when he is absent, after having been tuned together in a, it used to be called, secret exchange, that she misses that of him that now is at the deepest aliveness of herself. and starts to seek, where could he be? Marie-Louise von Franz takes the entire book of the Golden Ass, the not just the little, like a Bhagavad Gita in the Mahabharata, not just the Amor and Psyche, but she takes the entire volume. And it's interesting because Apuleius, when he was about 30 years old, having gone from the Roman province of Africa to Rome to study, then to Athens to study, and then was on his way to Alexandria, fell ill and was put up in the house of a friend, a fellow student from Rome, and his widowed mother discovered that she and Apuleius were able to have this love exchange. And so they decided to get married. That marriage, and because she was a very wealthy widow, everyone said he's marrying her for her money. And then they realized that she loved him. So then they said, well, he is a magician who has put a spell on her, and so let's get him tried as a false magician. And Apuleius, in one of the great classics of the ancient world, defended himself of these charges and wrote a little booklet on what magic is, what a human being is, and that he's clearly very conscious, but he doesn't manipulate because real magic is not manipulative at all. It occurs in an openness that no one controls or owns or can direct, but it comes as an invitation because one's coursing is in such a way that the whole field of what is magical is normal for you now in this way. He also learned from contacts that in Alexandria the Hermetica was the highest wisdom because it presented the great way of the highest teachers in Alexandria, which were Jesus and Mary Magdalene. And one of the formers of the Hermetica was Apollos of Alexandria, whose teacher was Philo of Alexandria, who was a longtime student and friend of Jesus and Mary Magdalene. And when they, in 34 AD, went to Palestine on that mission to bring back the wisdom that had atrophied so much there in the land of Sadducees and Pharisees and Roman manipulators, Philo headed the Alexandrian community of the Great Way, of Jesus's way, but it was a way with the two, Jesus and Mary Magdalene, in Alexandria. And Apollos was the one who, when Mary Magdalene not died, not passed away, the Greek wisdom term for it is comesis. A comesis is a sleep until called. And she was placed in an enormous tomb-like structure, in the Cave of the Seven Sleepers, awaiting till she is called out of eternal life to reassume her living being. Apollos was joined because when she passed into her kumesis in 57 AD, he's the one who went with his traveling friend, the great lawyer named Zenon. They went to perform the what we would call a funeral, but it was really a placing of her in the Cave of the Seven Sleepers. By the way, the Cave of the Seven Sleepers is mentioned in the Quran. It actually exists. It's there. Her great sarcophagus is still there. I have a photo of it. It was identified by the great scholar, French scholar of Sufi mysticism, Louis Massignon. And he's very famous for a four-volume study of one of the great mysterious Sufis, Al-Hallaj. But Massignon was also interested in Gandhi. And so one begins to see the interplay and exchanging beginning to go on all over the place. Mary Magdalene had raised St. John from age 12 under the assignment from Jesus, the last act on the cross, saying to her, "Behold your son," and to him, "Behold your mother." Now, his mother was the oldest sister of Jesus, Salome, born in Alexandria. But Mary Magdalene became his spirit mother to bring him from age 12 through his bar mitzvah at age 13 into a wider and wider dimension, plural, of consciousness. And at 57 AD, when after she was delivered to her kumesis in the Cave of the Seven Sleepers, he returned to Alexandria with Apollos. And Apollos, meanwhile, had understood that a lot of the early communities, which eventually would be called Christian, were not understanding the great way at all, but were in a kind of a new age revival of old traditions. And so he wrote out what became one of the most fascinating books in the New Testament. And when one is able to read the letter to the Hebrews, it's a letter to those Hebrews who are still Hebrews, that the St. Paul Christian communities were still Hebrews, but they were like non-Hebrew Hebrews. They were the uncircumcised. Now we'll call ourselves Christians. And Apollos in Epistle to the Hebrews is saying elegantly, everything is new. Everything is in the great way, which you must enter into by having a larger consciousness than that of the social realm of the world, than that of the individual empire of the ego. That there is a transform that continues to transform and finally distill, so that there are selfless persons on the great way. And the combination of Apollos and St. John in Alexandria from about late 57 AD until St. John left about 12 years later in 69 AD and went back to Ephesus, where he spent the rest of his life. But the legacy that they left in Alexandria became triggered about 10 years later when the man who had become Saint Mark, who at the death and crucifixion and eventual beheading of Peter in Rome, went back to where Peter had taken him in 44 AD, to Old Cairo, to an island in the Nile River, large enough to hold a massive garrison of Roman soldiers, and the fort, because it was built by Mesopotamian construction teams, was called Babylon. And it was there in Babylon that Saint Mark fled back to and was there for about 14 years and established a little chapel. It's called today the Hanging Church, because it was balanced between two of the great pillars of the Roman fortress, and the walls were about 20 feet thick. Massive place, impregnable, really. And that church is still there. And the chair, the bench chair that St. Mark taught on is still there. The podium is still there. All of this is still there and available to be photographed and to be seen and to be appreciated. But in 81 AD, when Apollos died, when he went into his kemisus, Mark, Saint Mark, left Babylon, left Old Cairo, and went to Alexandria. And so the later powers of constructing a church, Christianity, in Egypt it's called the Coptic Church. They say that their founder and the first Christian in Alexandria was Saint Mark. In response to that, the community of the Great Way in Alexandria began to look for a successor to Apollos and Saint John, and they did not find a particular person, but they found that there was a differential star of brilliant persons, and they are the authors under the aegis of Hermes Trismegistus who author the Hermetica. And so the Hermetica is the Great Way brought back into play in the face of this beginning of a construction of a kind of an organization called the Christian Church, which eventually would be able to morph to take over the Roman Empire. And when it did, it became as tyrannical to those of the Great Way as the Roman Empire had been to Christians all along. So there are qualities in books like The Grail, like The Golden Ass, like Time, and many of the other books of Marie-Louise von Franz, many of the books of all of the Hermetic Bodhisattvas that we're going to look at during the course of this year, and understand that we live blessedly in a time of the most wretched end to a time form imaginable, but at the very same time, blossoming like a lotus through that is the beginning of a new time form on the aeon level, on the millennia level, on the century level, on the generational levels. All of these layers are now in a, not a disclosure mode, but in an appreciation that there is not only much more to what is real, there is as much more as anyone could imagine. One of the things of Carl Jung, when he got into the I Ching, when he was able, with considered interchange with Richard Wilhelm, eventually had a relapse of his amoebic dysentery, he died in March of 1930. By the way, he was born May 10th, 1873, so we almost are giving this on the birthday of Richard Wilhelm. Jung, on the 100th anniversary of Wilhelm, was able, not the 100th, but the birth date on May 10th, was able to give a beautiful précis of him. And this is one of the things that he said. The précis is reprinted at the end of this edition of The Secret of the Golden Flower, the translation of a late Taoist yoga and with Jung's commentary and a translation. And he said, to me, the greatest of his achievements is the translation of and commentary on the I Ching. Before I learned to know Wilhelm's translation, I had for years worked with Legge's inadequate translation and was therefore in a position to fully recognize the extraordinary difference Wilhelm had succeeded in bringing to life again in a new and vital form this ancient work in which not only many Sinologues but even modern Chinese as well can see nothing but a collection of absurd magical formula. It is similar to the experience of coming to understand that a portal has opened, that a threshold is ready to be crossed. And for Jung, he took himself temporarily out of his psychological practice, and in his home on Lake Zurich, Bullington was the name of his home, he spent an entire summer, long summer, working with the I Ching and realizing that it wasn't just in the understanding by the symbolic structure of the mind or by the in-depth psychological unearthing from the unconscious, but that as he worked with the I Ching, it awakened in him the realizations, plural, that he was learning how to learn. And so he began writing a book on synchronicity, an acausal connective principle, that beyond causality of phenomenality, there is a synchronicity that operates mysteriously in what he still then called the unconscious. One of the great physicists of the early 20th century was Wolfgang Pauli, who was also a fellow liver in Zurich. And the two of them got together and published a book in translation. It's The Interpretation of Nature and the Psyche, Jung's Synchronicity and Acausal Connective Principle, Pauli's The Influence of Archetypal Ideas on the Scientific Theories of Kepler. Pauli was sensitized to Taoism, not by Richard Wagner, but by Niels Bohr. Because Bohr, in trying to understand what originally in 1911, 1912 was beginning to be called the Bohr-Rutherford atom, that there's like a center, like a sun, to an atomic structure, and then there were the orbiting electrons, which were like the planets and the moons and so forth, so that an atom would be like a miniature solar system. But he was beginning to recognize that with the quantum mechanical wave theory, the uncertainty principle, the wave mechanics of Schrödinger, that there was indeed something that reminded him again and again of the Tao Te Ching. And so when he was finally given a peerage in Copenhagen, on his family crest, he put the Tai Chi symbol. And he developed the theory of complementarity in quantum mechanics. And it was from Pauli's association with this community of geniuses around Bohr that he began to understand that Jung had also understood something which Bohr had understood from the Taoist, not perspective, but from the Taoist learning how to learn and being able to see the openness with focusing on one or the other, but then learning how to encompass both together so that they didn't come together, but that they danced and made the exchanges. And we call that today in nuclear physics entanglement, because they are created together. No matter where a pair of electrons might be in the world, in the universe, whatever occurs with one also occurs with the other, but in a syncopation. And does so also in terms of the electron holes, in terms of the positrons and their holes, so that there is an incredible interpenetration in actuality. And just to focus on phenomenality and on causality, linking phenomenality, is the height of delusion. It has no life. It has no mysteriousness. It tends to become more and more abstract, and abstract in a peculiar way. The Western philosopher who classically came to state this in a pristine fashion of puzzlement was Jean-Paul Sartre, his massive volume, Being and Nothingness, has a section called the whole. He says, at the center of everyone is a whole. Nothing is there. And it's the whole that of nothingness that sends us into this fright that we have to have something to fill that hole, something to cover it up. And that the ego and all of its apparitional operations is this kind of existential conundrum. Because the realization that finally will come is that you cannot fill that hole. The great French psychiatrist Hubert Benoit, who was the psychiatrist for Aldous Huxley and a number of other very famous people, wrote three books. The first of them was called Let Go. And it begins with a sentence. We spend all of our frenetic effort to deal with problems when the realization is that The problem is that there was never a problem in the first place. More next week. Mm-hmm.